This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Carolina's healthcare system joins with UNC Healthcare to form a medical giant. The first week of school seems to have gone smoothly, except for the wheel that came off the school bus on day one. The General Assembly approves new legislative maps mandated by the Supreme Court. The fate of those maps is now up to that court. Carolinians do what they can to help victims of Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and City Council responds to an affordable housing report featuring both good and bad news. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE Newsroom. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Os Helms, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, is here. Hello.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner reports for WBTV News. Good morning, Nick.
Hello.
And Glenn Berkins returns. He is publisher and editor of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. You can also watch us on Facebook Live this morning. We begin with some very unexpected news.
UNC Healthcare and Carolina's healthcare system are working to come together to form a new organization that blends the best of our two organizations, their high-performing comprehensive health system and our academically based renowned healthcare enterprise.
That's Bill Roper, the CEO of UNC Healthcare, announcing the coming together of Carolina's healthcare system and UNC Healthcare. Roper didn't refer to it as a merger, but rather as a partnership.
I think the reason we are calling it, and I think it's the best word, a partnership, is most people understand a merger to be, as Gene said earlier, put everything in one pot and shake it up. That is not happening. The two organizations continue to exist separately, but we will be doing lots and lots of things together in partnership under this new organization. Another metaphor that I've used in trying to describe it is this is like a marriage. And if I can extend that metaphor, what we're describing to you today is we've just gotten engaged. The wedding is still several months away, and we've got lots of stuff to do before the wedding.
So I believe the News and Observer in Raleigh and the Charlotte Observer here in Charlotte scooped everybody on this. You got advanced warning, or one of your reporters found out about this before the fact and had information about it. How long has this been in the works, Anne?
They've apparently spent a good bit of the summer talking about this, and they obviously have a whole lot of details left to work out, but they are now at the point where they have signed a letter of intent saying we are going to do this. You have to start briefing a whole lot of people, the Board of Governors, members of the General Assembly. So, yes, John Murawski of the News and Observer had gotten wind of this, and so we had this long conversation. They were in Raleigh. Some of us were on the conference call from Charlotte in which they were trying to explain what they know, what they still don't know, why we should not call this a merger but a partnership. And what they're saying is there will be a joint operating company that will oversee both organizations. And there will be what they called a new master brand at some point in the coming months.
So
here's the thing, though. If you have to say it's not a merger, probably means it's a merger. Just gonna point that out. And I mean, they have acknowledged that they're going to need regulatory approval for this in the future.
Right.
This, for all intents and purposes, is a merger, and it's going to create a giant healthcare system that cannot be rivaled in the state of North Carolina.
Okay, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to go back to the fact that the announcement took place in Raleigh and not Charlotte. And I believe, from the video that I saw, Bill Roper of UNC Healthcare System spoke first. What should we read, if anything, into that?
Well, I'm trying to remember if he did speak first. I mean, the video is snippets of the conversation, and it was very much presented as this is not one group acquiring the other group.
Right.
This is not, you know, the people who are state employees who work for UNC Healthcare are not going to stop being state employees. The Carolina's healthcare employees who have their own system of benefits and pay and all are not suddenly going to become state employees.
Mm.
It's again, it is not 100% clear how this will affect employees, which is a huge deal in the Charlotte region because they are the largest employer.
Was this news to most people who work for either hospital system?
I think so. I'm not sure. The oddest twist of this was I was telling my mom about this embargoed thing, and she says, oh, yeah, I've heard about this. I think it was on a sign in my doctor's office. I think she's probably confused about that, but I don't know. So There have to have been, word has to have gotten out. If you have talks going on over the course of weeks or months, there were probably people who knew, but I think they did a pretty good job of not leaking it until the last minute. I don't know when they actually had hoped to announce this. They announced this because John Murawski went to them and said, we're about to write a story.
So the paper forced their hand.
I believe so, yes.
Gene Woods, the CEO of Carolina's healthcare system, becomes the CEO of this new operating company, if that's the right term. Bill Roper of UNC Healthcare, who you heard a moment ago, would become the chairman of the board. Where would the headquarters be?
That is to be determined.
Around about Greensboro.
That is to be determined. They kept us saying that there would be 14 hospitals in this, but I read in the paper this morning there's like 50 hospitals involved in this. Which is the right number?
And I don't know if this has to do with their definition of hospital, if we're talking about whether you count clinics or urgent care centers. I don't know where that difference comes in.
Well, they said that all these hospitals would be impacted by this, and Bill Roper of UNC said that one of the things this partnership aims to improve is access to health care, especially in rural areas, and CMC CEO Gene Woods underlined that and then spoke about the heft this combined organization would have.
We have Levine Cancer Institute based in Charlotte, but we also have 25 distributed points of care throughout the Carolinas. We treat more cancer patients than many of the organizations in the country. We diagnose 12,000 new cancer cases every year. And then you look at UNC with the robust, rich research that they do. We said if we put these together, if you're in wherever you are in the state or Carolinas, if you had access close to home to the best clinical trials, together we do about 1,400 there, best clinical trials, and you wouldn't have to necessarily travel, what would that look like?
So these two organizations already share a number of resources, don't they?
I don't know. They have a medical school. A branch of the medical school is located here in Charlotte. So I think that is their main sharing point right now. One of the things they mentioned when they were talking about, is this an antitrust, a monopoly issue, that this isn't the same thing that it would be if Carolina's Healthcare and Novant merged, and all of a sudden all of the Charlotte region was under one big hospital company. This is two separately geographic areas that are now combining one much bigger footprint, but not necessarily holding a monopoly in either area.
One of the things they kept talking about yesterday when I watched this video was the fact that this will allow, and I alluded to that when I used the word heft, this will allow them to negotiate medical prices, et cetera. And they said, I think, it would help bring costs down. In the paper this morning, you and other reporters are saying that might not be the case. In fact, the reverse is going to be true. It's going to raise healthcare prices.
Yeah, there are two types of negotiating that would go on. And one is
they're lying to us, these two CEOs?
They never said, when I heard them, they never said this will bring down costs for patients. In fact, Dion Roberts, one of our reporters, specifically tried to say, are you saying this? And they kind of didn't answer that. So I think where it stands to bring down costs for them is when you are negotiating, whether it's construction or whether it's hospital beds or, you know, think of the many, many types of supplies that you're buying as a medical company.
Well,
they're now a huge, huge player. But then they have to also negotiate reimbursements from insurance companies. And in that case, their interest becomes higher reimbursements, and that can then translate to higher costs for
patients. The press release says, and I quote, the combination of these two would create a nonprofit healthcare system, one of the leading nonprofit healthcare systems in the nation, and would strengthen collaboration with other healthcare providers to improve patient experience and bring affordable care to the region. And what you guys said in the paper this morning was that because they will negotiate with insurance companies, what insurance companies pay them will go up, and the insurance companies will pass those costs on to all of us.
Yeah,
and
the way
if you're not insured, your costs will really go up.
Yeah, and the way their thing was phrased was about bringing care to areas. And I think that is something where they do stand to. A lot of this emphasis has been on areas not like Charlotte, but where there is not much medical care. And I do think they stand poised to do that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they emphasized was that essentially this is North Carolina taking charge of its own destiny, that if these two entities hadn't done this, you might have had somebody from Atlanta or Nashville or wherever coming in to start taking part of this North Carolina market. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
You're looking at me and not at Nick, who's apoplectic over here, and Tom wants to jump into this conversation as well. Who wants to go first?
Tom raised his hand first, so since we're in second grade.
Very good.
Part of school here, too.
Well, here's the point I would bring up. In that press release that you just quoted, Mike, the phrase was bring affordable care. Doesn't say lower costs, doesn't say make costs, you know, more affordable. Their definition of affordable care is probably what they're providing now. But here's the thing. You're talking about a state entity, the UNC school, mm-hmm. right, the hospitals, and a nonprofit hospital chain. And Ann's absolutely right. What we're dealing with now is a bigger footprint, a statewide footprint now, where these two combined would control a sizable portion of the market share. And you were right as well, and I'll get to my broader point here, but you were right as well that when you have control over a geographic area, in this case now instead of just Charlotte with CMS, with Carolina's healthcare service, sorry, and now you've got North Carolina with these two. So they negotiate rates with insurance companies, and that's key, and people forget that. If you don't have insurance and you're given a bill, you're expected to pay the full amount. If you have insurance and your insurance company gets the bill, they've negotiated a discounted rate so they don't have to pay that full listed amount. So what's the big benefit here to both? If they can negotiate together, they have more control over what they get paid by insurance companies, and they can also do some things that, frankly, Carolina's healthcare system is now facing two lawsuits over to decide. You know, I don't know the facts of the case, you know, the determination in the case, but you can control how much you get reimbursed and potentially where patients get sent by their insurance companies. That's dangerous.
And this is the very key point here, because when we talk about Carolina's healthcare system, we're already talking about one of the top five largest healthcare systems in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And that is significant, because when you talk about mergers and economies of scale, it all comes back to the prices you can negotiate with insurance companies. Tom just mentioned these lawsuits. One of those two lawsuits is a federal antitrust lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice and the North Carolina Attorney General a little more about a year and a half ago. And what that lawsuit accuses Carolina's healthcare system of doing is requiring insurance companies, if you want to be able to send your patients to our hospital, which you want to if you want to insure anyone in the Charlotte market, mm-hmm. because we control so much market share, you must do a provision called steering, where you require your insured to come to one of our facilities, and then they jack up the price that they're going to get reimbursed from that insurer. So this is a very dangerous, could potentially be a dangerous thing for patients, and that's something that regulators are going to have to look at. And so when they go out there,
but steering is different from mandating. Do they mandate?
No, that's exactly what it is. That steering is.
Nick's right. It's the exact same thing.
Okay.
I mean, and that's the key point here. And think about the dynamics that Nick is explaining. You would normally think that the insurance company gets to, you know, be in charge of these negotiations, because they want to pay the lowest rate. They want to be able to send their patients to wherever they can get, you know, quality care at a discount. But in a market like Charlotte, where Carolina's healthcare controls about 50% of the medical facilities in the area, it's the hospital chain that gets to negotiate, because if you're an insurance company and you want to do business in Charlotte, you have to have access to their facilities in order to be able to market yourself and charge premiums.
That's right. You hear the music, Glenn, but I know Glenn wants to chime in on this too. When we come back, we'll hear from Glenn Birkins on this, and I want to find out when this is going to happen, because it's a wedding, as Bill Roper said, we have to buy gifts. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Visit Abingdon, Virginia, where it's always playtime. Abingdon is a home to the Barter Theater, the State Theater of Virginia, with performances 6 days a week on two different stages. More at itsalwaysplaytime.com. And TEDx Charlotte, featuring live speakers and TED Talk videos, committed to fostering discussions and creating personal connections. October 13th, CPCC Halton Theater. Tickets at TEDxCharlotte.com. Prospects of a nuclear renaissance in the U.S. suffered back-to-back setbacks. In recent weeks, utilities in South Carolina abandoned a project about 80 miles south of Charlotte. Companies sunk billions of dollars into that project, and customers are footing some of the bill with higher electric rates. Then Duke Energy canceled nuclear projects in upstate South Carolina and Florida. Escalating price tags given as a big reason for scrapping the plan. So why is the nuclear comeback fizzling out? Guest host David Borax talks with industry experts about that and more Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Harvey's toll, a pardon for Arpaio, Sanctuary Cities, North Korea's missile over Japan. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The recap of the week's news continues at 10 o'clock with On Point, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup starring Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, Q-City Metro, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. We're talking about the engagement yesterday, as they put it, of Carolina's healthcare system with UNC Healthcare. And Glenn, you wanted to chime in on
that. Well, I thought everyone had raised some very good points. When it comes to the healthcare industry, size does matter, and I think it's going to be how they choose to use it. They can use that for economies of scale, as Ann talked about with construction, but it can also be very potentially dangerous if they use that larger scale to kind of bully their way and get what they want. I think it's too early to say that it will drive up costs, but I can definitely see where it could. Generally speaking, large is not always better when we're talking about things like healthcare or any competitive industry for that matter.
There's something in the article, and I don't have it with me, so I can't remember it, but there's something about economies of scale in the articles in the paper this morning about this. And if I recall correctly, one of the writers, and you were one of those writers, said, and that our healthcare system, Carolina's healthcare system, has pretty much wrung out all they can get in terms of economies of scale.
Yeah, and that, honestly, Ames Alexander and Dion Roberts are more of the experts on that, but they've done extensive reporting. You know, there's the whole thing that these are nonprofit chains, but they do, in fact,
make
a lot of revenue, if you want to call it that. So
it's a kind way to put it. I mean, and let's not forget that we're talking about a company in Carolina's healthcare system that is already being accused by federal prosecutors of using their size to bully people around. So, I mean, yes, we don't know what this new entity will do, but we know what the current entity is accused of doing. But we also should take a look at the assertion that, you know, Ann raised quoting folks from the hospital yesterday about the potential impact of having out-of-state hospital systems come in and needing to take charge of our health care. Well, North Carolina is already in charge of its health care because in North Carolina, in order to build a new hospital, to add one new hospital bed, to buy a new MRI machine or any other piece of equipment, if you want to make any change to the health care services that you offer in North Carolina, you have to go seek what's called a certificate of need from a regulatory board. So North Carolina already controls who's in its who is providing healthcare in the state, hyper so. And so I'm not sure that argument stands up.
I would love to be a fly on the wall in the Novant boardroom. You know, there's going to be some type of reaction to this. Novant's going to have to respond in some way. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine what that's going to be.
Well, and it's very possible.
Calling Baptist Hospital.
Well, where they're strong in Winston-Salem and go ahead and merge with them. But there's a very strong possibility they could mount a real serious challenge at the regulatory phase of this because it still needs to be approved by regulators in the state, and that could blow up this entire deal. In North Carolina, I mean, you see this all the time happen where you have two hospitals competing to want to provide the same healthcare services, and someone loses it most of the time.
Given the fact that Obamacare is still arguably in flux, we don't know exactly what's going to happen going down the road here with this, and that some people in Congress are now really seriously talking about single payer. If you were the CEO of a hospital system and you were counting on this merger or this marriage enabling you to really stick it to insurance companies, what happens if all that goes away?
Well, I think things like this are a clear sign that no one expects single payer to be a reality anytime ever.
Okay. When will this happen? This is the engagement announcement yesterday. So when will this happen? And when it happens, if it's not a merger, but it's going to have a central holding company, of which the UNC guy is the chairman of the board, and I can't think of his name. Gene Woods, CEO of Carolina Healthcare System, becomes the president. When will this happen, and what will it look like? What will it be?
Well, you probably don't need to rush out to get your blue sequin jacket dry cleaned just yet for the marriage. It's still several months down the road.
I have it ready. It's ready to go.
Okay. So they're saying about 6 months to work out a lot of these details, including where the headquarters are and what they're going to call this entity and how they're going to brand it and market it. And then, of course, the big question mark is regulatory review. And they were, you know, they were sort of, well, it might happen. We're certainly aware of this. I mean, it's going to need to be reviewed. Their best case scenario for themselves is that somehow, because they don't overlap in markets, that there's no need for them to do the monopoly discussion.
And because they don't overlap in markets, does that mean that the employers, the employees, and we don't know this because, as you said, we don't know a lot of details yet, but are the employees of the largest employer in Charlotte relatively secure in their jobs, unless they're back office people?
Yeah, I think that if you are working in a hospital or a medical practice, there's no reason to think that those jobs would go away. And they talked about overall employment expanding because they want to go into more underserved areas. Mm-hmm. But like you said, the back offices are probably a pretty hefty number of people working here. So if you're working in billing in Charlotte and you've got another parallel organization working in billing in Chapel Hill, it's reasonable to expect that there would be some consolidation, and whether more jobs come to Charlotte or Charlotte jobs go to Chapel Hill, we just don't know.
And part of that decision will be made on the salary scale. I mean, I can't stress this enough. This is an odd, odd merger. This marriage is a little – it's different because you're dealing with a nonprofit hospital chain and state employees and state assets in terms of the UNC hospital system. And that – it just can't be overlooked because the salary scales are different. And I honestly don't know what the benefits package differences between the state employees and Carolina's healthcare system are, but there are differences. And you also have – you need the state to give a big thumbs up, as Nick was explaining. And I'm willing to bet, knowing how much the state loves to try to cut down on costs, that there may be some kind of a pressure point to get to slough off some of the state employees in those healthcare systems that are run by UNC and shift them over to this nonprofit. That's speculation, but that dynamic between nonprofit, private, and public servants, public employees, that is going to play out, and that is going to complicate things.
Let's also not forget, not only do you need from the certificate of need the healthcare regulation side, but UNC is still UNC, and it's subject to oversight from the Board of Governors, as someone mentioned earlier, but it's also subject to the meddling of the hundreds of people who sit in the General Assembly and have thoughts about this. And I'm already hearing from people in Raleigh that this has caught a lot of attention from people who have a lot of questions.
All right, well, we'll continue to follow. This will be going on for months, I suppose. This be our new HB2.
Please don't.
Just when you thought you heard the last about the now defunct Charlotte School of Law, something else surfaces. This time the school's being sued by one of their former professors who filed a whistleblower suit against the school and its parent company, Infolaw.
Education is not what's important to these people. The shareholder seems to be more important. The investors are more important. And so I think that somebody had to stand up for the students, and that's what I did.
That's Barbara Bernier, the professor who filed the suit. She accuses the school of fraud in admitting unqualified students and manipulating enrollment to continue receiving government-backed tuition payments. What has the school said about this suit?
Well, basically, they've said that they're working with, federal investigators, because there's also a federal investigation of this. And that is the reason we know about her whistleblower case, because this was actually originally filed in Florida, and it was kept under seal for weeks and weeks and weeks because federal prosecutors here in Charlotte wanted to look into it, be able to interview people, get data before, you know, this motion, this complaint was unsealed. So we're hearing about this after the investigation has already started.
So her suit – let me see if we understand this correctly. Her suit allowed the federal government – to proceed.
So the way a federal whistleblower lawsuit would work is someone with inside knowledge of the operations of a company, in this case Charlotte School of Law, gets a private lawyer, they file a lawsuit that says, we know about all of this wrongdoing. And then in federal government –
involving federal money.
And that's a very key point, involving federal money. And we think the federal government would want to know about it and prosecute it. And so then the feds get a chance to look at it. And actually, normally it takes years. So the fact that – I think this timetable is actually pretty abbreviated, which I think is speaks volumes. And so the federal prosecutors review it and they decide whether or not they want to say, yes, we think you have something. We're going to go after this. And then they elect – whether or not to move forward and prosecute the claims. And so that is what has played out here.
So is this a red flag to a lot of these for-profit universities around the country that are engaging in some of these or have been accused of engaging in some of these activities, these tuition activities?
There have been whistleblower lawsuits filed against for-profit universities for years and years and years. This is not a new thing. If it's a red flag for anyone, maybe it should be a red flag for students considering enrolling in one of them.
Okay. Actually, I'm more surprised that we're still having them. Nick is absolutely right. They've been around for years, decades, not just whistleblower claims, but you know, pretty much everything we've seen play out at Charlotte School of Law. I'm just amazed that people are still putting tons of money to go to enroll in these institutions.
I totally agree with you, Glenn. And I have to say, I mean, there's two sides to this too. I mean, if you go back to the tail end of the Obama administration, you saw ITT shut down for fraudulent practices. They were no longer allowed to because of how they were treating veterans and others. And, you know, you've seen almost every major, if not every major for-profit college chain have these same kinds of issues, although INFLAW and Charlotte School of Law are at an extreme side of the scale if the allegations are true. But then you also have, you know, relatively new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who has come back out and said, we think for-profit colleges are a good way to go.
Doesn't she run for-profit schools in her private life, or didn't she before she became a Secretary of Education?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, right.
Well, but and so you look at they just appointed just this week the man who was appointed to oversee and more heavily regulate for-profit schools at the U.S. Department of Education came himself from a for-profit school, DeVry, that just recently had to pay like a $100 million fine. I think you're definitely under DeVos at the Department of Education, you're going to see an easing up of regulation compared to the Obama administration.
And not to get into presidential politics, but I think we have to remember who our president is and the fact that he himself ran a for-profit university.
And no one would argue, I think, from the Trump administration or Trump supporter that the Trump administration is unabashedly anti-regulation and that they're applying that to these industries that have been accused of taking advantage of students before.
Kind of an interesting coda to this, too. UNC Charlotte opened this week, and there had been some speculation that, well, now that Charlotte doesn't have a private school of law, they might open one. And Mike Gordon reported that Chancellor Phil Dubois said, no, we aren't going to do this because there's no market for lawyers. This would be extremely expensive and complicated, and we would be, no matter how well we did it, sending students out for a job market that just isn't there. Now, obviously, it is for some of the elite schools of law. Duke University, I think he reported that 92% of their law school graduates get jobs that require law degrees. But this is another signal that maybe if you've got a for-profit entity saying, come on in, we can get you a law degree and you'll be a rich, famous lawyer, that you ought to think twice and three times.
And that, at the end of the day, was the underlying problem with the Charlotte School of Law, is when you're in a business to make money, money has to come from somewhere, which is why they admitted these students that they are now accused of, you know, admitting improperly, because they needed to fill the seats to make money.
So who gets the money if this suit goes to court?
That's a great
question. Or they settle?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are actual federal guidelines, and I can give you kind of a range of what her part of this would be. The money at heart here, she claims that INFLAW and the Charlotte School of Law built the federal government out of $285 million. And the way that money came in is because of the students that we're talking about that were admitted or the changes. And to do this, you almost have to prove – you have to prove fraud and nearly conspiracy. But they did this, Charlotte School of Law allegedly did this by not only admitting students that were unqualified or underqualified, but also keeping them enrolled and inflating the scores and doing all of, like, there's a multiple step process here. So if Bernier wins the lawsuit, if the federal government is able to collect money back, it doesn't mean she gets the $285 million. It's based on how much the feds get back. So out of that
– but she gets a third of whatever
– well, 15 to 30% roughly is what – is that range. So it just matters on how much – because, the school has settled – you know, other things in the past.
Well, and you get triple the actual the government collects triple the actual damages. So they can collect up to, what is that, $700 million.
Okay. I mean, she gets
up to a third of that.
Well, speaking of school, Monday marked the first day of the first week of school at CMS under the leadership of new superintendent Clayton Wilcox.
I think today we had a really good day of school from North County to South County and all points in between. We had just, I think, an outstanding day.
So the good news was that the wheels stayed on the system. Unfortunately, at least one wheel fell off a school bus on the opening day of school. What happened, Ann?
Well, it's taken a few days to figure that out, and I finally got to have a phone conversation with Janet Thomas, who is their transportation director, and why it happened is still something of a mystery to all of them.
A lug nut problem, wasn't it?
A lug nut problem. A bus was rolling out on the second morning, taking a load of students to Geringer High School, mm-hmm. going down Eastway, and all of a sudden, two wheels fell off. It turns out it was the two wheels on one side. It's a double-sided thing. And she said when somebody handed her the report, she thought it had to be a bad joke because each wheel has 10 lug nuts. There are two wheels on that side, and apparently all of them came off, and all of a sudden the bus is scraping the ground, and these wow. huge wheels are running loose through traffic. So we can kind of laugh about it because nobody was badly injured, but it could have been horrible. I mean, people have been killed by truck wheels.
There had been brake work on the bus, I think,
August 17th.
August 17th, and evidently the lug nuts, they're saying, weren't tightened properly. And this was not a new mechanic. This is a long time.
Right, and they were on, but they were not torqued then. There's a follow-up step where you get them on there really tightly, and apparently it just didn't happen. But how they all managed to work loose at the same time is a bit of a mystery.
This shouldn't really be a shock to anyone. I mean, we've reported a year ago, we talked with a mechanic who worked at the CMS bus garage who said, look, we are woefully understaffed, which they are because CMS is having a problem finding qualified mechanics, and we have way too many buses to inspect and maintain at any given time. Now, that's not an excuse, but this is a problem, bus maintenance and problems with school buses in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools is a problem that has persisted for a long time, and what played out this week is just a reminder.
Yeah, they have 50 people who are in the position that this guy who did not do the torquing is in. Basically, the guys who do the inspections, do the crucial work, 50 positions approved, 9 are still vacant. So that's a pretty big gap.
And the truth is mistakes happen.
Yes.
And that's one of
Even more so when you're overworked.
Right.
But they're saying they've rechecked. There are no signs that any other buses have this problem. They think it was truly a one-off.
So aside from that, how would you assess the first week of school?
Well, you know, I think 176 schools opened in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, far more when you count charters and private schools. You know, more than 150,000 kids are back in classes. Teachers are teaching them. You know, it's an individual chemistry kind of thing, and I think that it did go well.
And evidently one of the concerns is the impact of this impending arrival of next year's student assignment plan, and they'll be looking at total enrollment numbers, which come out in September sometime, to see if it's had an impact yet. Are people fleeing the system already? Why would they be fleeing the system a year before this goes into effect?
Well, there are people who felt like the student assignment process did not go well for them, and there were huge numbers of threats, and there always are when CMS does something unpopular. We're going to leave, and some have. Whether it's a significant number, we'll see.
We're going to leave, but we're coming right back in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at duke-energy.com/future. And Hickory Museum of Art presenting an evening with Joel Sartori on October 14th includes a reception and book signing along with a discussion about captive animals. Tickets at hickoryart.org. Hurricane Harvey takes a toll on the Texas Gulf Coast. President Trump is expected to end an Obama-era program shielding young immigrants from deportation. North Korea fires a missile over Japan. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about as the National News Roundup takes our place at the top of the hour at 10 o'clock during On Point. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
David Porter, General Manager, Hendrick Acura, a WFAE underwriter.
Businesses more and more have to keep engaged with your clients and figure out a way to keep them coming back. WFAE seems to have that figured out. We have seen that WFAE has almost a lifetime loyalty among the listeners. We hear that on a regular basis.
To learn more, email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Ann Doss Helm from the Charlotte Observer, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. According to scientists, we have now seen what the new normal looks like in terms of storms and heavy rainfall. And of course, we're talking about Hurricane Harvey, which inundated Houston and caused unbelievable flooding. According to one source, it dumped the same amount of rain in just a few days that Charlotte receives in 13 to 15 months, and enough water for New York City to use in 69 years. Think about that.
Wow.
Does this now have the attention, then, of emergency management officials and preparedness officials in cities around the country, particularly low-lying coastal cities?
Well, I'm sure they're watching, and I'm sure that they will make, you know, the recovery efforts and whatever proceeds from this point will be used as case study, just as Katrina was and just as Sandy was. But the amount of rain, I mean, I didn't know those statistics, Mike, and they are kind of jaw-dropping. The thing that had stuck in my mind before that point was the fact that NOAA, who measures rainfall, you know, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric
Administration,
yeah, mm-hmm. that they had to create new color scales.
Yes.
To show the level of rain, because their current longtime scale just didn't do it anymore. And it's just – it's fascinating. And also, you know, it's a reminder, and I do hope people remember this. When it comes to hurricanes, the wind, the trees moving, that gets – you know, the roofs ripped off houses. That tends to get the pictures and a lot of media attention from every branch of media. Mm-hmm. But it's the water that gets you.
Yeah, and most people do not have flood insurance. And flood insurance is a government program. There are not many underwriters that write it privately. What is this going to mean going forward for people? Should we all be thinking about getting flood insurance? It's not that expensive unless you live in a floodplain.
I think that – and I also – so right now, some people are required to have flood insurance. And I think what this is going to do is force – planners to reevaluate who actually lives in a floodplain. And I also think it's going to force the federal government to rethink what they're charging for flood insurance. I mean, because the fact is, even though
it was already troubled, that insurance program.
That's right. And it's only going to get more troubled as it gets more taxed from this, even though a small fraction of the people whose homes were destroyed had flood insurance, is still going to have to pay out a lot of money in claims.
And I do want to.
And not just flood insurance, but. This needs to be a time when we really stop to reexamine what we're doing along our coastlines, especially in light of the fact of climate change and climatologists predicting a rise in sea levels. All along the Gulf Coast, they're still building. They're still building houses. They're still building hotels. They're still building developments along these low-lying areas. And if it's true that we're going to see the sea levels starting to rise, and we're going to have these storms, and they're going to be the new norm, you know, we're just in for a collision course.
Right. Well, the rainfall that fell was astronomical. It's never happened before, and so a lot of people in that area didn't have flood insurance because it never, ever, ever, ever flooded where they lived. And the problem is a lot – and we have this problem here in Houston – was that they developed so quickly in the last several years, and they've paved over all these spongy meadowlands that used to absorb water when it rained heavily, which it does along the Gulf. And we're doing the same thing here with putting in impermeable surfaces all over the place.
Yeah, and I do want to bring this up because it is important. It's easy for us here in Charlotte, inland Charlotte, not on the Gulf Charlotte, to think this is something that – we don't have to worry about. But, you know, everybody go back not that far in history and think about the giant rainstorms that hit South Carolina, and they didn't just hit the coast.
Right.
The massive flooding were in inland cities, places like Columbia and around Columbia. I mean, this is things that we do need to start thinking about. And Glenn, you're absolutely right. Like, the building on the coast, that's an issue. But I'm hoping that people all here, you know, elected officials and otherwise, start thinking about it here too, because these massive rainstorms, this does seem to be coming more and more often.
Meanwhile, Americans by nature seem to be generous, and they like to volunteer to help other people. And this is happening now in the aftermath of Hurricane Hugo. What organizations are out there from the Carolinas who are in Houston or helping people in Houston, either with goods or services or sending money, et cetera? Do we know?
I think Samaritan's Purse is there. I think there's a Swift Water Rescue Team. It's gone.
Carolina's healthcare system sent in. They were deployed by
airplane.
FEMA. Yeah, they sent two planes and eight medical teams. And there are a lot of people collecting money. How do you know that the money you're willing to give is going to go to somebody who will actually get it to the people in need?
That's a big, important question. And it's one that I know my wife and I have been struggling with trying to figure out because, you know, in the past, the easiest answer was you give to the Salvation Army, you give to the Red Cross, you give to the people who have these branches. But the Red Cross has been under a lot of heat lately, and deservedly so.
Thanks to great reporting from NPR.
And ProPublica. Yes. I mean, straight up. And, you know, if anybody's curious how they're doing right now in Houston, go on Twitter and look at ProPublica's feed because they're also struggling with this. You know, the best thing to do is the Red Cross is in an important position where they can, in theory, mobilize faster than other groups. But the best advice I've heard so far is spread your money out just to make sure that, you know, everybody gets a little something because different groups can do different things and we can't just fall back on the stalwarts anymore.
And one option if you're one of those families that had kids in CMS, every single school has collection boxes out. You have the rest of the weekend to go out and shop. They are collecting new clothes for children and toiletries. And then Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, on after Tuesday's collection, is going to consolidate all this and try to get it to students in the Houston area who have been flooded out.
And we have a link on our website with a variety of ways that you can help. It's WFAE.org, and it's right there on the front page.
Here's an important thing to sneak in and remember, too, though, is this is something there are going to be people in need a year from now, probably even 2 years from now. I mean, if you think back about 13 months ago, or 9 months ago, rather, excuse me, I can't add today, people were still suffering from Hurricane Matthew was hitting North Carolina, right? We still have people living in hotel rooms from Hurricane Matthew that happened last October and that are still in need of toiletries and clothes and food. And so this is a disaster in Houston that is going to need people's help for a long
time. Gas prices, which I heard initially were not going to go up because not many refineries were affected, we're going to be affected by this, have gone up because a third of our refining capacity has been affected by this. If this is going to become the new normal, these kinds of storms, is it time to rethink where we put these refineries?
You know, it's an easy question to ask, Mike. It's a much harder one to answer because the reason that so many refineries are located where they are in the Gulf and in Houston is a two-part answer. One is logistics. Once you start building a critical mass there, it's easy just to keep adding. But second, to get that critical mass, you need people to say, yeah, we're willing to have a refinery in our neighborhood. Yeah. And that is a much, much more difficult sell.
The other issue is it's just that they are port cities.
Right.
So when these ships come in, these tankers come in with the crude oil or whatever, it's easier to just build those refineries close to the port rather than have to ship it inland.
So how high have gasoline prices gone already in the Carolinas? How high are they likely to go? How long is this likely to last?
Oh, they've spiked about 25, 30 cents. They're expected to be up another 25 or 30 cents.
Is this legitimate or is this profiteering?
No, supply is legitimately – there is not a shortage of gas at this moment, but supply is going to tighten.
And I heard yesterday that the Colonial Pipeline, which runs through Charlotte and goes to New York, that gives us all gasoline along the East Coast, has been closed because of this. Why?
Because there isn't gas to put in it. Where does it start from? I mean, remember, we had a gas price spike when there was an explosion on this same pipeline, and that was in Alabama. I mean, what this boils down to, are some places possibly profiteering? I guarantee you lots of people will be looking at that to try to figure it out. But the reality is there's only so many places that refine so much gasoline, and that's the problem.
Well, and on the Colonial Pipeline specifically, part of it is also underwater, so even after it comes – reemerges from the water, it has to be reinspected to make sure that the integrity of that pipeline is safe to run gas through again. But I think it's an important thing to remember or for people to hear. There is gas, mm-hmm. so that you shouldn't run out today to go get it. Doing that only is going to make the situation worse because your gas station is going to run out of it.
So we have another hurricane to talk about, just very briefly, Irma, which is off our coast, but it's pretty far away from our
coast.
It's
closer to Africa than it is to our
really,
coast.
Really far away.
Is it likely to impact us? Do we know what the meteorologists are saying about the likely path?
Well, you've got to think, this is a storm, if it is going to be a big deal for the Carolinas, that we're probably not going to talk about until next Friday.
Yeah.
This could be a weekend event. But
at the earliest.
But the thing to think about is, it's in a spot right now where you normally only find tropical depressions or tropical storms. Mm-hmm. It is already a Category 3 hurricane. This is worth watching.
Yeah, okay. It is.
The Republican-led General Assembly in Raleigh has approved new legislative district maps to replace those drawn in 2011 that were thrown out by the courts due to illegal racial gerrymandering. House Republican David Lewis oversaw redistricting, and he seemed to believe that this new map solves the problem.
It adheres to traditional redistricting principles, and it remedies defects the court found in the previous map. It splits fewer counties and divides far fewer precincts and fewer municipalities than previous plans from this body.
So, what do these new maps look like?
I'm going to let Nick start here because you haven't been on it a bit, and I have talked about this. I'm curious to see what you think.
These new maps look like maps that you would expect Republicans to draw because it still does benefit them. But when so he's talking about, you just heard David Lewis, he chairs the House map making committees. I'm paraphrasing that a little bit, but he ticked through some of these boxes. So they tried to keep whole counties together in districts. They tried
mandated by law.
Well, you know, that, well, it, whenever possible, because let's also remember map making is hard, right? But so these maps look a little more compact if you're comparing old and new, but they still give Republicans an advantage, or, you know, based on just numbers and voting history, if that's what you're asking.
So they have until September the 15th, I think, at 5 p.m. to get – no, when is it? September
today.
Today.
They have until – this is
today,
my favorite deadline because the court was so specific. They have until 5 p.m. September 1st to deliver approved maps.
All right. So that goes in today, and the Supreme Court will make the final decision on whether these – no?
No.
Who makes the decision, Tom?
So,
excuse me.
No. This Supreme
so
Court –
so confusing because everyone's going to have a say.
Yeah, the Supreme Court – the U.S. Supreme Court did agree with a lower federal panel that found the 28 racially gerrymandered districts. The Supreme Court also appointed that exact same panel to be in charge of overseeing this new map. So that panel, it's kind of an amalgam of different judges. They're the ones who will decide whether or not these maps pass muster. And there are basically three things they can do. The first is give it a big thumbs up and say, you're good to go. This is set now for the 2018 elections. The second thing they can do is say, not good enough, guys. Go back, redraw. And the third option, which is not used often but could be used if the court is angry enough, is the court can appoint a special master to redraw all of the legislative maps or redraw all the districts that the court deemed did not fit what they wanted.
That would be surprising.
It would absolutely be surprising, but it's an option here.
Because we also saw the court, that three-judge panel originally when they overturned these maps, they ordered some additional measures that were also pretty extreme, like having a special election this year that we didn't end up having. And we saw the U.S. Supreme Court kind of walk some of that back while they upheld the illegal racial gerrymandering, which was a new question before the court or a new issue that the court, you know, new guidance that they issued. They kind of walked some of the panel's orders back.
And House Minority Leader Darren Jackson, a Democrat, said he didn't think that the GOP racially gerrymandered districts in 2011 because they were racist. They did it because they wanted to preserve their political control at any price. But political gerrymandering isn't illegal yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. So why didn't they just do it that way?
Well, they did it that way too.
This is a really important question, and it's at the heart of these maps in this case. And it's because one of the defining ways as a whole, and again, I hate to use broad categories for groups of people, but that's what they did here, is that African-American voters broadly tend to support Democrats. So there are a couple of ways that they could easily go through to gerrymander the districts to make them more Republican-friendly. They can use voting history, which is what we did, what they did in this, these new maps. And by voting history, I mean, you know, what precincts tended to vote for whoever. Or they can use race, and they chose to use race, and it's even more complicated than that, because then you get into the Voting Rights Act and you get into all sorts of other questions.
City Council heard a report this week about affordable housing, and there was good news and bad news. We have a surplus of workforce housing, which are middle-income people, but a crisis in terms of need of affordable housing, which is for low-income folks at the lowest end of the ladder. Anything else that came out of that we didn't already know?
It seemed to me that people were kind of surprised at the surplus number, and I think I saw some discussion about what actually qualifies as affordable housing, because I think there are a lot more people who we have a surplus, I think there are a lot of people who think they can't afford that.
Also this week, President Trump's Justice Department reversed an Obama administration decision that will soon make more military and military-style equipment available to police departments around the country. But CMPD is planning to say no to the offer. CMPD spokesman Rob Tufano here.
We participated in that program in the 90s. We no longer do participate in that program. So we don't have, we don't use, nor are we requesting any of that type of equipment. So it's inconsequential here as far as this organization goes.
You know, some of this includes rocket launchers and grenade launchers and things like that. Does any police department in the United States really need that kind of equipment?
Probably not. I think this was one of the more unfortunate decisions by the Trump administration. As we saw in Ferguson and some other places, our civilian police departments have become incredibly militarized, and I don't think that leads to good policing or good community relations.
Well, we don't have time now to talk about the continuing spotlight being put on golf, particularly at Tiga Cay.
And you were so eager.
I was. Where a couple
the puns were lined
well,
up.
Well, this is an instance of people having...
Leave it be, Mike. Thanks very much for joining
golf
us.
Course.
Well, it gave a whole new...
All right.
Yep. Leave it
nice
be.
To four
thank you all for the hour.
Thank
you all for the hour.
Nick Oxner, Glenn Birkins, your spoiler.